So we resume this evening in the 28th chapter of The Life Divine, Supermind, Mind, and the Overmind Maya. This is the last chapter in Book 1 in The Life Divine, and a chapter that Sri Aurobindo added because he felt that he needed to explain more thoroughly how it is that a divided and inconscient universe rises from a manifestation out of a divine being who is conscious, who is delighted at his own self-experience. How does that oneness, in translating itself into manyness, get lost in darkness? And simply to speak about supermind and mind gives us no insight into that. Instead, through his own experience, he discovered that there is indeed an intervening consciousness, a layering of truth upon truth, a diminishing of totality into what is merely colossal. Of integrality to what is merely comprehensive. This intervening consciousness he called the overmind, and he has been describing it as the apex of our ascent upwards as we draw away from the limits of mind and rise to the higher mind, beyond that to the illumined mind, into intuition, and then finally into the cosmic expanse of the overmental awareness. In the previous page or so, he drew an image from the Rig Veda, from the 10th mandala in the Rig Veda, in which he was looking at the term of the inconscient ocean, Apraketam Salilam. That is a very profound hymn of creation, the Nasadiya hymn, which we've met before in the 25th chapter when he was looking into the nature of matter. That was a chapter called The Knot of Matter. He translated there the first five verses. And we see that those verses begin to appear again in these paragraphs. One last week, cited as 10.129.3, it was the fifth footnote. And then as we pick up this week's work, we find again an immediate evocative image coming from the Rig Veda. And he says, overmind, in its descent, reaches a line which divides the cosmic truth from the cosmic ignorance. It is the line at which it becomes possible for consciousness force, emphasizing the separateness of each independent movement created by overmind and hiding or darkening their unity, to divide mind by an exclusive concentration from the overmental source. So this is recalling images that we saw at the beginning of this chapter as well. The one from the Isha Upanishad, the face of truth is hidden by a golden lid, as if there's a truth hiding a greater truth. And then the Taittiriya Upanishad, it became both truth and falsehood, satya and amrita. It became the truth, even all this that is. So, a powerful image, a veil, a line that divides transversally what is above from that which is below, the truth above, and what becomes the cosmic ignorance here. And by doing that, while each movement thrown out by the overmind gets its own independence, its right to function and be, it is at the cost of the inclusivity of the supramental consciousness, separateness gets established. To continue, he says, there has already been a similar separation of overmind from its supramental source, but with a transparency in the veil, which allows a conscious transmission and maintains a certain luminous kinship. But here the veil is opaque, and the transmission of the overmind motives to the mind is occult and obscure. So there are two veils. As we leave the supramental consciousness, there is a transparent veil. It's pouring its riches, it's pouring its luminousness into the overmind, a global consciousness which catches it, understands what its position is in relationship to the supermind, realizes that it is in deep, profound agreement with it, that it knows what its work is. It takes all these multiplicities, understands their oneness, and then turns to the act of creation. And a second veil is created. And through that second veil, the many get distributed out and lose their centrality in the oneness. And as they proceed forward, they have each line a unique mission. And each has registered something authentic from above that it carries inside itself. And so it knows that its mission is correct, but it goes out forgetful of its inclusiveness in the larger whole. So this is what we receive at the level of mind, at the heights of mind, receiving all of this multiplicity from the overmind. Now things stand as if they were different. Mind separated, he writes, acts as if it were an independent principle. And each mental being, each basic mental idea, power, force, stands similarly on its separate self. If it communicates or combines with or contacts others, it is not with the Catholic universality of the overmind movement on a basis of underlying oneness, but as independent units joining to form a separate constructed whole. So we're moving from part to whole. It's an act of construction, but not something which is spontaneous and innate. The cosmic mind on this level, no doubt, comprehends its own unity, but it is not aware of its own source and foundation in the spirit. It can only comprehend it by the intelligence, not in any enduring experience. It acts in itself as if by its own right, and works out what it receives as material without direct communication with the source from which it receives it. And so, above, if we talk about that line which divides the cosmic truth from the cosmic ignorance, that is the fifth verse of that hymn to creation. Quote, their ray was extended horizontally, but what was there below? What was there above? And now here we meet what is an echo of the seventh verse. That out of which creation has arisen, whether it held firm or it did not, he who surveys it in the highest heaven, he surely knows, or perhaps he does not. So we have left the field of certainty because our experience would authenticate what is real or not to us. But when we look at it as if it is an object outside of us, then it is no longer part of our experience. And we regard it, we might be able to construct a whole from it. But here, the whole is divided from its units. And the units may wish to reestablish the whole, that is the operation of the mind, but they can never achieve it because they don't have an inclusive vision. They don't have a vision which knows by identity. He continues, its units also act in ignorance of each other and of the cosmic whole, except for the knowledge that they can get by contact and communication. The basic sense of identity and the mutual penetration and understanding that comes from it are no longer there. All the actions of this mind energy proceed on the opposite basis of the ignorance and its divisions. And although they are the results of a certain conscious knowledge, it is a partial knowledge, not a true and integral self-knowledge, nor a true and integral world knowledge. So, what kind of truth would they have? It's neither true of the own subjective experience, it's neither true of the larger cosmic experience. So through this veil, the manifest energy has become disjointed. Integral, by the way, again, comes from the word that means whole, integer, and also suggests what is integrated. And what is integrated becomes part of one's own self. But if this seems to be outside yourself and you cannot know either the essence of your own self or what the true essence is of the cosmic whole, then the knowledge is shaped but not fixed in the figure of the spirit. And, pardon me, the next paragraph then continues this. Yet as in our subliminal or inner mind, so in this mind also, a larger power of communication and mutuality still remains, a freer play of mentality and sense than human mind possesses, and the ignorance is not complete. A conscious harmony, an interdependent organization of right relations, is more possible. Mind is not yet perturbed by blind life forces or obscured by irresponsive matter. So here he's describing the inner, the subliminal reaches behind the surface of nature. And although they are within the field of ignorance, they are less obtuse than we get, as he continues to describe. It is a plane of ignorance, but not yet of falsehood or error. Or at least the lapse into falsehood and error is not yet inevitable. This ignorance is limitative, but not necessarily falsificative. False is a word that means wrong. It's from the Latin falsus, a past participle of fallere, which means to deceive. So, we have different divisions within the field of knowledge. There is a pure knowledge, by suggestion here, of that which is known by identity. That would be spiritual and essential. When we begin to ignore what we really are, and we lapse away from that integrity of being, we can still know in a sense, but it will be a limited knowledge. It will not be full. It will not be integrated in the whole. It can be erroneous, but it will not be false. Falsehood arises when the separation is so complete that each iteration, each step, leads from error to error, that it will not have the substance of knowledge behind it. So to continue, there is limitation of knowledge and organization of partial truths, but not a denial or opposite of truth or knowledge. this character of an organization of partial truths on a basis of separative knowledge persists in life and subtle matter for the exclusive concentration of consciousness force, which puts them into separative action, does not entirely sever or veil mind from life or mind and life from matter. So he is still describing here the subliminal reaches of the cosmos in saying that while we have limited knowledge here, it's not a complete plunge into darkness. This is not the falsity that we could potentially arrive at later. The complete separation, he says, can take place only when the stage of inconscience has been reached and our world of manifold ignorance arises out of that tenebrous matrix. So when we have plunged from overmind through mind into life and through matter, finally into the inconscience below matter, now we have reached a stage at which it is possible to have lapsed apparently from our context in the consciousness of true being above. Now we seem to have become the nadir of being. So we have come to a complete separation, or so it seems. These other still conscient stages of the involution are indeed organizations of conscious force in which each lives from his own center, follows out his own possibilities, and the predominant principle itself, whether mind, life, or matter, works out things on its own independent basis. But what is worked out are truths of itself, not illusions or a tangle of truth and falsehood, knowledge and ignorance. But when, by an exclusive concentration on force and form, consciousness force seems phenomenally to separate consciousness from force, or when it absorbs consciousness in a blind sleep lost in form and force, then consciousness has to struggle back to itself by a fragmentary evolution which necessitates error and makes falsehood inevitable. So these are those separations of these three principles of Satchit-Ananda, where they become divorced from each other and separated from each other. It means that we have a lapse into the limited power of the life plane, into the darkness and insentience of materiality. And we have to grow back towards oneness through a fragmentary evolution. And along that route, we're going to make errors. We're having to reconstruct unity starting from a complete darkness. It's so dark, you might say it's a superb darkness. Nevertheless, these things too are not illusions that have sprung out of an original non-existence. They are, we might say, the unavoidable truths of a world born out of inconscience. So again, he refuses the idea, and this is fundamental to his view, that there is something like a non-existence. To him, to say that something is non-existent means that it is a being which is beyond all formulation, that what you say of it positively does not suffice to describe it, that it escapes and eludes even that definition. Even the darkness of the inconscience is not illusory. It has fundamentally placement in the entirety of this divinity, which is everywhere, beyond time and space, surely, but also absorptive of the universe within itself. So this is contra Shankara. Nothing springs out of non-existence because non-existence does not exist all is existence, and everything that arises from existence has necessarily some aspect of a truth power and a real existence within it, however dulled it may be, whether it is inconscient or material or living or thinking. It has within it the sublimity of Sat-Chit-Ananda, and that which is beyond Sat-Chit-Ananda. For the ignorance, he writes, is still in reality a knowledge seeking for itself behind the original mask of inconscience. And what is the ignorance? The ignorance is the entire manifestation. And the entire cosmos, the inner worlds, not just the external expanse of the physical universe, but the entirety of the cosmos, is a manifestation which is seeking to rediscover itself. Its whole process and the many processes within the universal process are looking to experience and rediscover ultimately that from which they came. Still in reality, a knowledge seeking for itself behind the original mask of inconscience. It misses and finds its results, natural and even inevitable on their own line, are the true consequence of the lapse, in a way even the right working of the recovery from the lapse. So while the ignorance seems to grope, misses and finds, so is not perfect and quick in its rediscovery of its origin, in consciousness, in being, in experience of its own delight, the way that it is following is right for it. So if the cosmos seems to be dimmed and seems to be a field of sorrow, and we'll get to this more in a moment, then it is part of the will, the expressed will of the divine, that it be so. It is not an accident. It is not a freak occurrence. Existence, plunging into an apparent non-existence, consciousness into an apparent inconscience, delight of existence into a vast cosmic insensibility, are the first result of the fall and, in the return from it by a struggling fragmentary experience, the rendering of consciousness into the dual terms of truth and falsehood, knowledge and error, of existence into the dual terms of life and death, of delight of existence into the dual terms of pain and pleasure, are the necessary process of the labor of self-discovery. So having passed through that transversal line, that obscuring veil by which the ever mind pours out the infinity of the supramental finally into the manifest universe as we experience it in mind, life, and matter, this triple term of Sat-Chit-Ananda is translated into dual terms. Losing its triunity, giving it up, becomes truth and falsehood, becomes life and death, becomes pain and pleasure. He says, a pure experience of truth, knowledge, delight, imperishable existence, would here be itself a contradiction of the truth of things. It could only be otherwise if all beings in the evolution were quiescently responsive to the psychic element within them and to the supermind underlying nature's operations. But here there comes in the overmind law of each force working out its own possibilities. So, if the universe were so established that the supermind was overtly governing all of the operations in the cosmos. And if we had full knowledge of the flowering soul power within us, then we could move swiftly towards the consummation which apparently nature seeks to achieve. But that would prohibit something that the overmental manifestation gave permission to in releasing this multiplicity into energized action in the cosmos. The many coming into play through the overmind have each a right to explore and discover themselves. And they do that often without harmony with all the others, but they do it with a real purpose. They have begun from division, but the seed of unity is planted within them. It will be inevitable that that will reemerge. The natural possibilities of a world in which an original inconscience and a division of consciousness are the main principles would be the emergence of forces of darkness impelled to maintain the ignorance by which they live, an ignorant struggle to know originative of falsehood and error, an ignorant struggle to live engendering wrong and evil, an egoistic struggle to enjoy, parent of fragmentary joys and pains and sufferings. These are therefore the inevitable first imprinted characters, though not the sole possibilities of our evolutionary existence. Still, because the non-existence is a concealed existence, the inconscience a concealed consciousness, the insensibility a masked and dormant ananda, these secret realities must emerge. The hidden overmind and supermind too must in the end fulfill themselves in this apparently opposite organization from a dark infinite. So while maximum liberty has been given, which allows this apparent chaos to begin, we will eventuate in a completing fulfillment. We will exceed the character of the current world we experience, which does not give us a complete picture, however much it justifies spiritual escape. We look at this world and we see it's horrible. We want to quench suffering. We want to get away from division. We want to regain a unified and greatened consciousness. And so we leave the cosmos in order to achieve it. What Sri Aurobindo's statement here means is that there is a cosmic effort to return to that Sat-Chit-Ananda from which it emerged, and that it must in fact inevitably return to it. So the way to proceed is not by exit and departure, but through evolution, to continue to grow, to move out of darkness into dimness, from dimness towards illumination, from illumination to full enlightenment. It is to grow from insentience through pain and pleasure back to ananda. It is to grow from fragmentary being and division and alienation back into mutuality, and from mutuality to eventual unity. Two things render that culmination more facile than it would otherwise be. Overmind, in the descent towards material creation, has originated modifications of itself. Intuition, especially with its penetrative lightning flashes of truth, lighting up local points and stretches of country in our consciousness, which can bring the concealed truth of things nearer to our comprehension, and by opening ourselves more widely, first in the inner being, and then as a result in the outer surface self, also to the messages of these higher ranges of consciousness, by growing into them, we can become ourselves also intuitive and over-mental beings, not limited by the intellect and sense, but capable of a more universal comprehension and a direct touch of truth in its very self and body. So the first of these two things is that we can be guided by intuition descending into us from above. And you can see how he is describing here a yogic reworking of the inner being to be able to receive and retain and arrange such a growing conscious power that leads us from penetrating insight to a greatening awareness of that which grows and becomes cosmic, leaves even the intuitive lightning flash to reside rather in the solar orb of the overmind awareness. In fact, flashes of enlightenment from these higher ranges already come to us, but this intervention is mostly fragmentary, casual, or partial. We have still to begin to enlarge ourselves into their likeness and organize in us the greater truth activities of which we are potentially capable. So, what he's describing here is not simply the inner experience of enlightenment by which we come to know the essential self, that which is beyond time and space, but rather how that spiritual consciousness plays in the cosmos. To be able to move beyond that inner and passive experience and become active and dynamic in concerting that power, in harnessing it and allowing it to expand and greaten our own being, is all the yogic effort that leads us to fulfillment, towards the siddhi. So we have yet to do that. We may have an essential experience of spirit, but have we done something to dynamize it? Of course, Sri Aurobindo's yoga was entirely about that. The essential realizations he had had decades earlier. By now, he is working on a far grander program, and that program is being evocatively explained here. So that was point number one, intuition leading to overmind, and all of this becoming active and dynamic in our being. But secondly, overmind, intuition, even supermind, not only must be, as we have seen, principles inherent and involved in the inconscience from which we arise in the evolution and inevitably destined to evolve, but are secretly present, occult actively, with flashes of intuitive emergence in the cosmic activity of mind, life, and matter. So they are involved and present with us now, already active in ways that mind, life, and matter can receive them. As in the rest, where it may be sporadic in nature, these too are present within us. If intuition and overmind might play in us, so too might supermind. It is true that their action is concealed, and even when they emerge, it is modified by the medium, material, vital, mental, in which they work, and not easily recognizable. Supermind cannot manifest itself as the creator power in the universe from the beginning. For if it did, the ignorance and inconscience would be impossible, or else the slow evolution necessary would change into a rapid transformation scene. Yet at every step of the material energy, we can see the stamp of inevitability given by a supramental creator. In all the development of life and mind, the play of the lines of possibility, and their combination, which is the stamp of overmind intervention. As life and mind have been released in matter, so too must in their time these greater powers of the concealed Godhead emerge from the involution and their supreme light descend into us from above. So again, he describes here an ascent and descent which leads to the recreation of the cosmos. The supermind's inevitability and the overmind's licensure to the play of cosmic possibles is here at the root of this cosmos and cannot be lost by whatever experience we may throw up now of division, of the limited character, of the unsatisfying experience that we have of this universe in Act Two of a longer cosmic play. We have farther to go before we can say in our own experience what was the purpose of the cosmos. Here, at the level of the mind, we can only guess. We cannot know utterly. A divine life in the manifestation is then not only possible as the high result and ransom of our present life in the ignorance, but if these things are as we have seen them, it is the inevitable outcome and consummation of nature's evolutionary endeavor. The high result and ransom. Ransom is a word that means redemption. In a sense, what seems to have lapsed into darkness in nature demands redemption. And who is it that will do that but the evolving soul, who is key to the cosmic riddle, who must unite spirit and matter, who must make Ananda the ultimate experience of the universe, who must reveal that true Sat is at the basis of all our experience. This is the end of Book One, the omnipresent reality, as Sri Aurobindo described it. When we next meet, we'll take up Book Two, and it will take us years to complete. I think this evening we'll continue with our passage from Savitri. We've been in Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight, in Canto 4, the dream twilight of the earthly real. There, the perfection born from eternity calls to it the perfection born in time, the truth of God surprising human life, the image of God overtaking finite shapes. There, in a world of everlasting light, in the realms of the immortal supermind, truth who hides here her head in mystery, her riddle deemed by reason impossible in the stark structure of material form, unenigmaed lives, unmasked her face, and there is nature and the common law of things. There, in a body made of spirit stuff, the hearthstone of the ever-living fire. Action translates the movements of the soul. Thought steps infallible and absolute, and life is a continual worship's rite, a sacrifice of rapture to the One. A cosmic vision, a spiritual sense, feels all the infinite lodged in finite form, and seen through a quivering ecstasy of light, discovers the bright face of the bodiless, in the truth of a moment, in the moment's soul, can sip the honey wine of eternity. A spirit who is no one and innumerable, the one mystic infinite person of his world, multiplies his myriad personality. On all his bodies seals his divinity stamp, and sits in each, immortal and unique. The immobile stands behind each daily act, a background of the movement and the scene, upholding creation on its might and calm, and change on the immutable's deathless poise. The timeless looks out from the traveling hours. The ineffable puts on a robe of speech, where all its words are woven like magic threads, moving with beauty, inspiring with their gleam, and every thought takes up its destined place, recorded in the memory of the world. The truth supreme, vast and impersonal, fits faultlessly the hour and circumstance. Its substance, a pure gold, ever the same, but shaped into vessels for the Spirit's use, its gold becomes the wine jar and the vase. All there is a supreme epiphany. The all-wonderful makes a marvel of each event. The all-beautiful is a miracle in each shape. The all-blissful smites with rapture the heart's throbs. A pure celestial joy is the use of sense. Each being there is a member of the self, a portion of the million-thoughted all, a claimant to the timeless unity, the many's sweetness, the joy of difference edged with the intimacy of the One. But who can show to thee truth's glorious face? Our human words can only shadow her. To thought she is an unthinkable rapture of light, to speech a marvel inexpressible. O death, if thou couldst touch the truth supreme, thou wouldst grow suddenly wise and cease to be. If our souls could see and love and clasp God's truth, its infinite radiance would seize our hearts, our being in God's image be remained, and earthly life become the life divine. Namaste.
Namaste.
Jai Ma.